All right. Thanks everybody for coming. It's my great pleasure to introduce Michael Ernst, who's visiting us from University of Washington. He's close, but I feel like we need to have more kind of meetings and things with the people of Redub because there's a lot of great work going on. So I ran into Mike at FSE, and we were talking. He's like, "We should have you come over and talk to us for a day." So I'm really excited to see or to hear what he's talking about. So Mike Ernst is a full professor at UW. He actually got tenure at MIT before he came to UW as well. Has a number of best papers, NSF Career Award winner. I think the list of awards he's gotten is off the charts. We've actually collaborated with Mike successfully a few times, so he'll be here for the remainder of the day. I think his schedule is mostly full, but if you'd like to talk to him and you're not already on a schedule, send an email to Tom Zimmerman. He may be able to make that happen. So with that said, I'll turn it over to Michael.
Thanks very much, and I'll be back too. So it's a real pleasure to be here. Thanks for coming. So I want to talk today about how natural language is actually a programming language. But let's set the stage first. So how many people here have used software? Okay, how many people have written software? Okay, what's software? Sorry, Patrice?
Software is a program that executes.
Okay, a program that executes.
A program that you tend to swear at more.
Yeah?
We all know it's a trick question, so nobody wants to answer.
Well, no, there are multiple correct answers. Okay, if you're Thanksgiving and your aunt asks you, "What is a program?" What would you answer?
So when people ask me what I do, I work for the VC compiler. I tell them that when you write a program, you do it in English. I work on the program that turns that into computer reads.
Okay.
There's a bunch of instructions that tell the computer what to do.
Yeah, and that's actually what I tell my aunt at Thanksgiving. It's a sequence of instructions that perform some task. It's a recipe. And if you follow the instructions, the task gets performed. And of course, there are different types of programming languages. There's high-level ones that people can read. There's low-level ones that the machine can actually execute. And so this is a really powerful way of thinking about software. I mean, essentially, you're saying this is an engineered artifact. It's amenable to formal analysis. We can define it. We can understand it. And then we can perform formalisms like these. I've done lots of this. I'm not going to be talking about that because a program is more than just a sequence of instructions that perform some task. When you're writing software, that's one thing that you do, but you do much more besides. If you're a software developer, what other things do you interact with besides just the sequence of instructions?
All the words in the program?
What?
All the words in the program, all the
Sure.
identifiers that tell you what it does.
Sure. So there are variable names in a program. I mean, when we think about this, we've abstracted all those away, right?
And perhaps RFCs and standard documents?
Documents, specifications, the requirements that your users have. There's a lot of data that it's processing, absolutely.
Comments.
There are code comments, maybe. I mean, I've heard there are programs without code comments. Yeah.
Like runtime feedback, when you run the program, you see like output or errors.
Yeah, there are test cases, and then there's the results of running those test cases. All of these things are part of the software. Isn't it a shame that we ignore all of these when we view the software as merely a sequence of instructions? This is an incredibly powerful way of viewing software, but it's also a really limited way. So I think we should be analyzing the entire program, not just the AST, not just this abstraction. So I want to think about how can we analyze all the rest of this information that is available with your software. So rather than thinking of software as an engineered artifact, I think we should also need to think of it as a natural artifact, something from the real world that we have to sort of poke and prod at, use statistical techniques to try to understand. And there's a lot of work that takes this kind of approach. You can do machine learning over the executions. You can think about the version control and analyzing that. You can do bug prediction, determine if upgrades are safe. You can think about prioritizing warnings. You can repair the program. So let me give you just one example of something that I did earlier, which is this machine learning over executions. So there's a lot of papers that start out with, given a program and its specification, blah, blah, blah. But again, most programs don't come with a specification. For instance, if you think about formal verification, you write the program, then you test it. No one would be crazy enough to try to formally verify a program without testing it, because testing is an incredibly effective way of finding some problems in it. And then you throw all the testing artifacts away, and you try to formally verify it. Why do we do that? Programmers have put all this really important semantic information in the tests. So is there a way we can convert tests into specifications? Because specifications are a sort of test, but they're not the kind that's useful to formal verification. So there's some work. There's a system called DICON that does a technique called dynamic detection of likely invariants. The way that that works is you run the program, observe all the program, the values that it computes, and then generalize over them by machine learning. You get these likely invariants. These are things that you might see in a search statement or a formal specification. Things like x is greater than the absolute value of y, or some linear relationship, or that an array has no duplicates, or that for every node n, n.child.parent is the same as n. Because it's a machine learning technique, it's unsound. Because every machine learning technique has a bias, it's incomplete. And it's wildly useful. It actually turns out to be surprisingly accurate. So this is a way of taking one of those artifacts that people have put so much time and energy into and formalizing it. So I want to think about, OK, what are other things that we could do this, take the same approach? Are there other artifacts that are currently informal that we can formalize and then use in useful ways? And I'm going to be thinking today about natural language processing. So there are a couple ways to think about the structure of this talk. One way to think about it is the problems that are being solved. I'm going to talk about inadequate diagnostic messages, about operations in your program that are incorrect, about tests that are missing, or about functionality that you haven't implemented. Another way to think about this is, what's the source of the natural language that we're going to be processing? You can look at the error message strings. You can look at the variable names. You can look at the code comments. Or you can look at questions that users pose. And the third way is, what's the natural language technique that we're going to use? You can use document similarity. You can look at the semantics of words. You can do parsing. Or you can do end-to-end translation. And if you look at these, they're each coming from a different decade of natural language processing, from earliest to latest. And then a final way to break this up is that these first two problems are about analyzing existing code, and these last two problems are about generating brand new code. So this is the outline of the talk. I'm going to talk about each of these four. I'm going to tell you about four different projects, each one briefly, and tell you how we can extract information from natural language and then use it in a formal way. Please stop me and ask me questions. There's a lot of cool stuff here, but I can skip over stuff. And I'd much rather that we have a good conversation than just hit every slide. All right? Great. So here's the problem with inadequate diagnostic messages. A user has supplied a wrong configuration option, like in a configuration file or as a command line argument. So for instance, passing port number equals 100.0. And then the problem is that the software often issues an unhelpful error message. These are real error messages. One of them is related to this, and the others are for other software. Unexpected system failure or unable to establish connection. And the end user doesn't have access to your source code. The end user really has to diagnose from this. So our goal is to figure out when are the diagnostic messages is going to be helpful to end users, and when are they going to be mysterious to end users. That's our goal. So that we want in-house to predict the diagnostic messages that aren't going to be helpful. Who would be a better error message? Port num should be an integer. So the goal then is to proactively detect these inadequate diagnostic messages. There are really two questions you need to ask. One is, how do we create configuration errors to see if the messages are going to be inadequate? And the other is, how do we determine that the message is actually inadequate? So there are two parts to this work. We have built a tool called conf diag detector that that does this. The idea of triggering a configuration error is make fake errors. So do configuration mutation and then run the system tests. So the idea is you had some configuration, change some part of it. We don't know whether that's erroneous or not erroneous, but then run the system test and look at all the failed tests and look at the diagnostic message. Now, for each of these, we know what the exact problem was. We know which part of the configuration we've mutated. This whole process is going to be repeated hundreds of times for each piece of software. So for instance, we know that we have changed port num or some other particular thing. OK, so now we have a and so some of these are going to trigger no error, and some of them are going to trigger an error. So for those messages, how do we know whether the message is inadequate? Well, we're going to use a natural language technique to check the semantic meaning. In particular, we're going to compare diagnostic messages that are output by these failed tests to the user manual and ask, do they have similar semantic meanings? If they have similar semantic meanings, then we speculate that this message will lead users to the right part of the user manual. Question, yes?
What's a user manual?
OK, so here, what we have done is looked at man pages or the PDF or HTML. And we have parsed that to figure out which part of the manual is about each of the configuration options.
Do people still write those?
So if you have software that has no help pages, no information that you could scrape off of any source, then you may have bigger problems.
Well,
so
no authoritative pages.
Sure. So maybe you would end up getting this off of the developer mailing list or a wiki or Stack Overflow or somewhere. So for right now, we're assuming we have some text about each of the configuration options. Question here. One moment.
Yeah.
So you're saying here is that we're looking for an entry that's semantically equivalent to the error message?
Almost. So I'm going to explain this in just a second. But what I have is I have text in the user manual about each of the configuration options. So as you have 100 configuration options, I'm going to ignore all the rest of the user manual, and I'm just going to have the text, 100 little snippets of text about each of those 100 different error messages, each of those 100 different configuration options. Yeah?
So I want to make an observation. I'm not an expert in this by no means, but a lot of the cool kids these days generate user manuals for API in the cloud directly from the source code. You write these tools, and you maybe extract them from the comments. You have a certain way to annotate the source code to derive these user manuals.
Yes.
And in my experience, a lot of those annotations are done at the time when the code is written, so they're identical to the diagnostic message. In other words, if the code says, if this happens, then throw out this error or print this message, then in the comments you basically copy and paste that thing. So the semantic meaning would be identical in this, using this technique.
Okay, so I haven't seen that for the error messages. So typically, if you were trying to document something like port num, the documentation for port num is not going to say unexpected system failure or unable to establish connection. But you're right, the documentation could come from anywhere, including from the source code, as you pointed out. So we assume that you've got a manual or a web page or man pages or some other location. That was Andy's question. Yes?
And you're assuming that it's actually a useful manual?
No, we're not.
Okay.
We're going to tell you whether it's a useful manual.
Okay.
Okay, so when is a message actually adequate? So one answer is, if the message contains the name of the configuration option that's wrong, that's useful. And this is work that people have, other people recognized that before. So if you mutated percentage split and the diagnostics message is the value of percentage split should be greater than 0 or less than 100, that's useful. The thing that we've added here is it should have similar semantic meaning to the manual description. So for instance, the mutated option is fnum, and the diagnostic message is number of folds must be greater than 1. But the manual description says sets number of folds for cross-validation. Then someone reading this could probably look in the manual, find this, and determine that it's the fnum configuration that's actually the issue. Does that make sense? Okay. So the so essentially all we really need to do is do document similarity, right? I have one document here, I have another document here, and the question is, are those documents similar? Or another way to think about it is, this diagnostic message, looking at all of the documents here, which one of them is it most similar to? So the classical document similarity technique is TF-IDF plus cosine similarity. So there are two steps here. You convert the document into a real valued vector, because natural machine learning techniques are awesome because they can deal with any data you you want as long as it's a vector of reals. So you convert your document into a vector of reals, and then you determine document similarity by vector cosine similarity between those two documents. Let me make that a little more concrete. This may be familiar to a bunch of you. The vector values are term frequency. So the length of your vector is the dictionary size. For instance, on this slide, it contains the word classical twice, the word document 8 times, the word problem 3 times, the word values 3 times. And so this is the vector value for this particular slide. Now, the problem here is that frequent words are really common, words like the. And if your message contains the word the, you don't want to choose the document with the largest number of occurrences of the, just because it looks most similar. So the solution is that you change your values, so your values aren't just term frequencies, but they're term frequencies times inverse document frequencies, where inverse document frequency is the log of the total number of documents divided by documents with the term. In other words, if you have an infrequent word and it's in both, that's really important. If there's a frequent word that's in both, who cares? Not so important. Awesome. This works really well. It's been known for a long time, and it doesn't work on short documents. It works really well on long documents. So we use a different technique from the natural language processing community that says two documents have similar semantic meanings if a lot of words in them have similar meanings. So for example, you might start with you're trying to compare the program goes wrong to the software fails. So first this removes the stop words. Those are meaningless words like articles. Then for every word, you look for similar words. For instance, program is similar to software. Goes wrong is similar to fails. I'll talk to you a little bit later about how you could do that. There are multiple techniques for doing that. And then finally, two sentences are similar if enough words are similar between them. So in this case, these are considered similar. So the way that this works then is you look at your diagnostic message, you say, which part of the manual is it most similar to, and is that the right one? So this will tell you a diagnostic message is inadequate if either the diagnostic message is terrible or if your manual is terrible. I think that's a question that you were asking. So if your manual is actually missing or content-free, we're going to say most of the diagnostic messages are inadequate, because it's not the case that the diagnostic message leads you to the right part of the manual. Question, yes?
Out of curiosity, if the diagnostic message is only a very small part of the entry for that manual, mm-hmm. how do we view similarity and usefulness in that context?
So it's still you're still going to look for keywords that are... So if there are enough words from... Essentially, what we're going to do is look at the words from the diagnostic message and then find which manual entry is most similar to it. So it has the most number of those words, essentially.
So if there's an entry that only has half of the words in the diagnostic message, but it's really short, another one that's really long but has all the words, we prefer the long document?
So TF-IDF would do that. This technique is not as good at doing that. But this technique is good at having the very short sentences. So that's a trade-off. So we looked at, we ran this on some open source software, Weka, JMeter, Jetty, and Deerby. It reported 43 bad messages. 25 of them were missing, so that's pretty easy. But the 18 were found to be inadequate by the tool. We had three programmers look at all the messages, and we asked them, would this have led you to the issue, and the programmers all agreed which were useful and which ones were useful and which were not. And our tool had a 0% false negative rate and a 2% false positive rate, which compares favorably to the previous best result, which was 16% false positive. Andy.
So you're using the term, it would have, would the error message lead you to the part of the manual that explains it? In a tool like Visual Studio, every error message has a unique code, mm-hmm. probably linked to the strings in the file. And that code is in the manual. So that
good point.
Would be a perfect identifier to link you to. Would that give you a perfect score?
I expect it would, because that would be a word that appears
only in
that part of the manual.
But it doesn't necessarily say anything about the text or the semantic meaning of the words, whether they're adequate or not.
Right. Yeah, so remember we said the first criterion was whether it contains the option name. You could imagine putting or a unique identifier
sure.
up here as well. So right, we're looking at these open source programs that don't have this useful piece of diagnostic information. Okay. Yes.
On the previous slide, you specifically said it says two sentences are similar. Does that mean that this technique only is applicable
to very short documents? Two documents. Okay. But yes, this technique is only, remember, TF-IDF is great for large documents. This is one that's really intended for short documents. And typically, so it says the documents have similar semantic meanings. Typically, there's going to be one that's very short, just a sentence, and the other is that's maybe only a paragraph.
So I guess, you know, it seems like there's a general capability here, right? Which is to say, tell me if these sentences are semantically similar.
Right.
Is there a sort of generic API that, we have these cognitive services now as a company, right? And so is there a generic API that you can imagine calling? They would say, give me the semantic nearness of these two sentences or something like that.
Yeah, so there are a bunch of well-known algorithms for doing that. TF-IDF is one. This is another one. There are actually many other techniques for doing it. And there are more modern ones that are actually better.
I guess what I'm asking, though, are there libraries that you can just call out to?
I'm not aware of them.
Okay,
no.
So why not? It seems like a great opportunity, right? Because this is one instance, but you can imagine many possible uses of those kinds of questions.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I don't know why that hasn't been commercialized. Okay, great. So there's a bunch of related work on diagnosing techniques that after they've already been exhibited, or stuff that requires really low level tracking of code, and ours just looks at the output. So now I'm going to tell you about another technique for figuring out incorrect operations based on variable names. So the problem is undesired variable interaction. So if I show you this code, you can look at this and figure out that this code probably has a bug. Now, we don't have a spec, but just looking at the variable names, there's something really suspicious here. So on the other hand, the compiler, you shouldn't be adding shipping distance to the item price. But the compiler issues no warning, but a human can tell that there's something suspicious here. So our idea is, how can we do this automatically? So here's the technique. First, cluster all the variables based on the words in the variable names, and then cluster all the variables based on usage in the program operations. Now I have two different clusterings, one based on variable names, one based on variable usage. If those clusters are the same, your program is probably well-written and correct and has good variable names. If they're different, then either there's a bad variable name or there's a bug in the program. So here are a bunch of variables. If item price and distance interacted, that would be bad. On the other hand, the program types are maybe these are all integers and these are all floats. What we really want to do is look at the language. And if you had to cluster these based on the language, you'd end up with these clusters. So let me show you that graphically in another way. We're going to first cluster based on the language, the variable names. Then we're going to cluster based on the interactions. And then we're going to look at the differences. So this one's a problem because one of the tan clusters has multiple blue clusters within it. This is not a problem. Here I have a bunch of things that are interacting. And I have these things interact. Maybe this is based on distance in one part of the program, and this is based on distance in another part of the program. They don't have to all interact. But when we have two things that are interacting but are using very different names, that's a problem. So how do we do the clustering based on operations? We use a technique called abstract type inference. What it does is it would convert all the integers here into three different types. The blue ones that are dates, the red ones that are distances, and the green ones that are prices. So how did it do that? Essentially, by looking at operations. If you have two variables that are compared to one another, the programmer must have meant them to be the same type. If you have two variables that are added to one another or assigned to one another, they must be the same type. So essentially, this just took all the variables that ever interacted and put them in clusters. Yeah?
Do you pay attention to the types of operations?
No.
Because I can see addition being different than like multiplication, for instance.
Right, so the tool that we're using has four different modes. And one of them allows addition, one of them allows addition and multiplication, another one allows none of those. Ben?
Have you looked at, or have you applied this to spreadsheets? Type inference in spreadsheets?
I think it would make a lot of sense to do. We haven't applied it to spreadsheets.
There is a body of work on type inference because it's in some ways even easier, but you could probably almost certainly apply some of the naming because they have names for things like columns, et cetera.
So. Right. Yeah, I think all of this stuff would be applicable, for sure.
There's also been a lot of work on unit inference.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So this is depending on whether you permit multiplication and addition, this can get closer or further from unit inference. This is coarser than unit inference. So, for instance, if you permit multiplication, division, then you would have one cluster for physical quantities, which could put acceleration and distance in the same bucket. Whereas if you forbid multiplication from joining two things, you'd end up with those things in separate buckets. Is there a question?
You've been getting to it, but when you multiply distance by a rate, you turn it into a fee. And so that kind of muddies the water. Would the tool complain that if I was doing that in a single operation, single expression, that I'm missing an abstraction? Or it seems like you get a lot of false positives here.
So again, you could, let's talk about false positives in just a second. But this tool has all these different modalities, and we use the coarsest one. Then for clustering based on variable names, what we did was, our goal is just compute variable name similarity. Given two variable names, I want to know, are these similar or not? What's the distance between them? So the first thing we do is we tokenize every variable into dictionary words. Like in auth's key would turn into in authentication's key. So this knows how to do camel case, it knows how to break things up, it knows how to expand abbreviations. Then we compute word similarity. And here we're using WordNet. That is essentially a dictionary with hyperlinks, and you just see the number of hops that it takes you to get from one word to another word. So there are better ways to do it today, but this worked well enough. And then given the word similarities, you combine them into variable name similarity, essentially by taking averages and maxes of the word similarities. So at the end, what we have is a real number, which is a similarity between two variables. And that's enough to do clustering. So we ran this on grep and on the XM mail server. And the very top-ranked mismatch, and then it ranks all the mismatches. Essentially, what it does is it looks at every name cluster, and it looks for it looks at every value cluster, and it looks to see whether there are two highly distinct name clusters within it. That is, things that are two clusters that are very far apart from one another within it. And it ranks them that way. And the very top-ranked mismatch indicated an undesired variable interaction in grep. Turns out that this assignment is losing 3 bytes of depth. It's not actually exploitable. That fact is due to guards that are elsewhere in the program. It was not at all obvious here. So you would want to do more experimentation on this to figure out whether this is actually going to be helpful to people. The other reports that it gave us turned out to be, code smells maybe, but not really bugs. So there's been a bunch of work that shows that reusing identifier names is really error-prone. Suggestions on how you should name, like Hungarian. There's a bunch of work on units of measure, on inferring units of measure. And people have previously tokenized variable names. It turns out that our technique outperforms these other techniques for doing that.
What do you mean by tokenizing variable names?
That was like turning in auth's key into in authentication's key. Yeah, exactly. Yes?
Do you do, when you tokenize the variable names, do you do any kind of stop or removal there too? Or is that not applicable?
So I do not remember whether we do that. I know that we do not permit. So it has to end up as dictionary words. And so if you've got if you've got something that isn't in the dictionary or is very short, those will get tacked onto longer words, and those won't end up being in the dictionary.
You don't discard ones that are not found in the dictionary?
Oh, so if it's not found in the dictionary, then the similarity is just edit distance, Levenshtein distance. Yes.
For the evaluation, the programs were written in what language?
They're C. They're C language. They're C programs.
I would expect this would be more perhaps effective in like very aggressively untyped languages. So why?
It's probably true. Because that's what we tried first. That's what. But I agree. If you've got, I mean, it's also the case that these are old. Grep is a very old program, and their variable names are not that good. I mean, today, people write much longer variable names that are more descriptive. Chris?
So a little bit tangential, but I look at that list and think, of the universe of programs that have ever been written, why did you choose grep and XM?
It was the student's choice.
Like that, okay. Did you try anything else, or was it just...
No, so he moved on to another project. So we have a workshop publication on this. Seems promising. We don't know how well it would work on programs in other languages, other programs. Yes.
There are also sort of conventions about variable names that are not expressed in that token. They're not captured by your tokenization, like the fact that I is always a loop variable.
Right. You could imagine building that kind of smarts into it. And one thing that we did was we did a very small amount of domain-specific abbreviation expansion, like auth into authentication. But then our system knows how to pull the pluralization off and tack it back on afterward, that kind of thing.
How big is your word dictionary? Is it hundreds of words, thousands of words? I used it.
Oh, it's WordNet. So it has definitely tens of thousands. I would assume hundreds of thousands or millions of words. Yes?
Well, for C code, how hard is it to use the tool that you have on another code base?
I think it should be direct. I mean, we essentially have a tool that that computes these variable interactions, and that's off the shelf. We didn't make any changes to that. Then we have code that tokenizes, and then we have code that clusters, and code that compares the clusters and sorts.
You don't need to build the code, et cetera. You just kind of lightweight parsing the code.
This tool is a dynamic tool. So you can imagine doing this kind of abstract type inference statically or dynamically. It turns out that the static techniques are really not very precise, and you get much better data from the dynamic one. So we used a dynamic one here. You could imagine using a static one, but we used a dynamic one. So that requires you to run the code. This part doesn't require you to run the code or build it even.
But if you're running the code, then you're getting code that was happened to have been executed.
Absolutely correct. Yes, so that's a limitation of the dynamic.
What sort of coverage did you have on these guys?
We used the test suites that they shipped with. Okay, let me tell you about another project which generates missing tests for you based on code comments. So. Just as a reminder, so our goal is to create test oracles. And as a reminder, a test consists of an input and an oracle. So the input for a unit test is often a sequence of method calls, and the oracle is often an assert statement. So one problem is that sometimes programmers don't write tests at all. And sometimes when people write tests, they use trivial oracles, like, did my program crash or not? And we'd like to use better oracles than that. There's been a ton of work, including by me, on automatic generation of tests. Turns out that generating test inputs is really easy. Generating test oracles is a terrible open challenge. Essentially, that's asking you, so what's the specification? What's this program supposed to be doing? So our goal is to create test oracles automatically from things that programmers are already writing, because programmers may not have written those good test oracles or formal specifications. So what's something that programmers already write? We'll come to that in just a second. Let me tell you about, so I talked about automatic generation of tests. Here's a real automatically generated test. Here's the code under test. It's a class called filter iterator. It has a constructor and it has a next method. Here's an automatically generated test. You create a new filter iterator and then you call next on it. This passes the compiler, you run it, and it throws a null pointer exception. So we found a bug. We found a bug in the code, right?
Specification.
Maybe this is the expected behavior. Maybe it's supposed to throw a null pointer exception if you pass null in. Maybe it's an illegal input. You're not even allowed to make this call. Oh, sure, it's allowed by the compiler, but it's not allowed by the specification there. Or maybe we actually found a bug. How do we know which one of those is true? We have no way of knowing that unless we have the specification for this. So it turns out that I left out the Java doc here. And it says throws null pointer exception if either the iterator or predicate are null. That's this, the documentation for next. So it turns out that this is actually expected behavior. It's required behavior. So a test generation tool generally outputs passing tests that are useful for regression testing and failing tests that indicate a program bug. But if you don't have a specification, the tool has to guess whether a given behavior is accurate. In other words, the tool generates a bunch of tests, and then it starts flipping coins, trying to decide, does this indicate a bug, or does this indicate, or is this correct behavior that we should put into the regression test suite? So that means it suffers false positives when it reports a failing input, like if it reported that this thing was a bug, or false negatives if it took this thing and threw it out and said, I'm not going to report it. So we've built a tool that automatically generates the tests, these tests, and reduced false positive test failures in NevoSuite by more than a third. So what are we going to use? Well, it turns out that programmers do write code comments. It's kind of shocking, but in Java, JavaDoc is a standard procedure documentation. This is true in other languages as well. Your IDE automatically inserts it, and people will write these things. Furthermore, it's really nicely marked up. For instance, JavaDoc has param, return, and throws tags. It also has a free paragraph. Right now, we're only processing the param, return, and throws tags, and this free paragraph is really scary. Maybe in future work, we'll try to figure out how to do that. So this, for instance, says that the check locked routine should throw unsupported exception if the comparator is locked. Here's another example that my method throws illegal argument exception if the element's not in the list and is not convertible. OK, so under what circumstances should my method throw that exception? Can someone turn this into a code expression for me? This is Java, a Java expression for me, just based on this Java doc. Yeah?
Element is not in the list or is not convertible.
Well, element is not in the list is not Java code. Right. I want Java code. I want something I can execute at runtime.
How do you check if it's in the list?
All found so far are not contained.
Okay, good. All found so far dot contains
and can convert.
That contains what?
Element.
Yes. And
can convert.
Element. And not element dot can convert. Oh, but need to pass in the, oh, that's not called on. So yeah, and not can convert, and you pass in the elements, the argument.
Yeah, it's this, right? So you were able to generate that. Okay, if you can do it, a computer should be able to do it. So this is the code. You should throw an exception if not all found so far contains element and not can convert of element. Question?
So sort of just a question around the informality of natural language versus the formality of programming languages.
Uh-huh.
You specifically say if and only if in the specification, but the comment says if, which is much more ambiguous than you want. How do you deal with that?
Okay, so that's a great question. And right now we're treating if as if and only if. When we parse this, we're going to treat if as if and only if.
What do you do about or, though?
Sorry?
In natural language, or tends to be...
Or can mean or and. Right, so we have heuristics.
And also whether it means exclusive or.
Right, so if someone says writes or, they could mean or, exclusive or and. And so we have heuristics for dealing with that. They kind of work. Chris?
Okay, so the writing here, like, oh, it's really handy that it's convertible and there's a can convert and I can figure out that the list is also found somewhere. But like the vast majority of like JavaDoc or C# documentation stuff is like in no way this close to the code that I would generate for like the assertion or whatever. What percentage of the time do you actually see stuff that's that I say easy, even though technically I can think even this would be easy to translate?
Right.
What percentage is even this easy?
So our system is able to translate more than a quarter of all Java doc, and it's getting precision recall that are in the 70% to 80% range. So there's a lot of stuff that it just can't deal with at all. Like I looked at my own code, and there was a lot of stuff that said throws IO exception if there was a problem reading the file. You know, that's useless. But the ones like, but you know, if you can at least get some of them, you're going to be able to improve your tests. So how do we do this? Let's start. The intuition here: nouns in your documentation correspond to objects in the code. Verbs in your documentation corresponds to operations in your code. So let's parse. Think back to fifth grade when you did parse trees. You didn't do these parse trees in fifth grade. But essentially, this is a sentence that consists of a noun phrase and a verb phrase. The verb phrase has a verb and this adjective phrase, and you know, this is what it looks like. Now, why do we do that? We did that to figure out which are the nouns and which are the verbs. Now we're going to take each noun and we're going to figure out which variable or expression in the program that corresponds to. And we're going to do the same thing for each verb. And now once we've done that, all we need to do is reverse the parse. And you end up with an expression that corresponds to this input sentence. So,
do you try both alternatives? For instance, in this one, would you also try current max.compareTo else?
Okay. No, because we know this one is greater. If this had been is less, it would still have been compared to, but it would have been compared to less than zero.
And he's talking about swapping the argument.
Seems like you wouldn't swapping always know which object should go. You'd have to try the different objects and all the different slots that they could fill.
Because A may have an operation that accepts a B, where B doesn't have an operation that accepts A.
Or element could be null, and then you're screwed. Then you assertion.
Right. Assertion. Okay. So I think you're asking, maybe I should have changed these two arguments to put them in the other order.
Yeah.
In that case, we would have wanted this to be less than zero instead of greater than zero, but our system can handle less than as well as greater than. So. We have a system called Toradoku that does that.
Yeah. Question. You imagine this is an affirmative sentence. Imagine this sentence being in passive, where it would be the adverb would be in fact the one that drives the predicate, not the subject. So how did you know that the subject is greater than that and not the maximum is greater than the element? That's actually the question.
I see. So we're using the Stanford parser for this. There are other good parse algorithms that you could use. And then we looked at, we actually have some stuff to deal with whether this is passive voice or it has some a few other special cases that it deals with. But for the most part, we just use it to tell us. The main thing it tells us is which are the nouns, which are the verbs, and what's the general structure. We translate the nouns to objects, the verbs to operations, and then we recombine them. Currently, we only try the one most likely parse and the most likely translation. And we give each one a score. And if the score is high enough, we just output that. And so Toradoku sometimes gets the result wrong. OK, so this parses throws expressions. Actually, as of the last week or two, we are also parsing param and return. You use a Stanford parser. That gives us back a parse tree and grammatical relations and cross-references. These are often not well-formed. We use code snippets as nouns and verbs. The references are implicit. It assumes coding knowledge. There, we did a bunch of stuff to deal with this. We match each subject to a Java element. We do some pattern matching. Otherwise, we look at lexical similarity to identifiers to types and to documentation, essentially edit distance, Levenstein different distance. Do the same thing for matching each predicate to a Java operation this should be. And then finally, we create an assert statement from the expressions and the these methods or operations. So we evaluated this on 381 throws clauses. It got 82% precision and 57% recall. And you can tune the parameters to favor precision or favor recall. It turns out that the pattern matching here is really important, and all the pre-processing we do up here turns out to be really important too. Ben?
So when you say precision recall, so this is, you have a ground truth which says this is the correct
right
expression that this should generate.
Right.
That's okay. That's basically.
So humans went through and wrote those.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Okay.
Andy.
It seems like you can combine the generated assertions with DICON and figure out whether if those assertions fail all the time, they probably weren't right.
So we could do it.
Used to run, and now it doesn't.
Right. So we're not doing that, but that actually makes sense. You could imagine doing that.
And that could be a way to distinguish between multiple forms of the same assertion.
Right. So the thing that we're implementing right now is we've added this into a test generation tool so that whenever you generate a test, it expects a particular assertion be thrown, or it expects that a particular exception not be thrown. So essentially, it enriches the test. People tend not to test for exceptional behavior. And so this is very useful in automatically generated tests. Early on, we were talking about the difficulty of determining whether the behavior was expected or not expected.
How did you pick the 381 clauses?
Convenient sampling. So they're from Apache Collections and a couple of other libraries.
But
so here's another fact.
Was it selective in the sense that a human could figure out what the expression was, and so we're going to use that one? Or was it just an arbitrary sample?
So when we chose a class, we took all of the assertions in that class. I'm pretty sure. So we have just finished param and return tags, and we're in the middle of integrating with the test generator. So there's a bunch of related work on heuristics for what's this test supposed to do. You can use specifications. There's a bunch of stuff on looking at properties if you have them and specs if you have them. And you can also look at natural language documentation. All of these have essentially just looked for, is something supposed to be null or not null? That's really, and pattern matching. Yeah.
You said earlier that the free form or essay part of the Java doc comments was scary. And
right.
Do you have any thoughts on what you can do with that?
The next part of my talk might give one idea, but we're really trying. So, and I have some other stuff I'd be happy to talk with you offline, but it's all very speculative. I don't have anything that I think is actionable right now. Ben.
For the ones where it failed, how easy was it to tell that it was the wrong expression?
So some of them just didn't compile.
Okay.
And others, we haven't done a user study to figure out how hard that is. We look at some of them and you can see that they're wrong. But it's also the case that sometimes it just gets an and for an or, for example. We've seen it do that. Or we've seen it
get the first clause right, and then and then something that's just completely wrong.
Yeah, I'm just curious about the actual process. If you were to run this over, you know, a project or something, how long it would take for somebody to go through each one and confirm whether it was the correct one or not? Right?
Yeah, I mean, precision of only 82% is kind of scary. If I were going to do this over a bigger project, I would probably want to strengthen our matching heuristics so that your precision would go up even though the recall would go down. Okay, I'll talk to you about one final thing quickly, and this is how do we create brand new code? So machine translation has been tremendously effective, tremendously successful. It does things like it'll translate the English sentence, my hovercraft is full of eels, into the Spanish sentence, mi aerostatador está lleno de anguilas. And that one's actually pretty easy because there's a one-to-one correspondence. But in Spanish, you might say, don't worry. And in English, you might say, don't worry. In Spanish, you say, no te preocupes. But they're able to do this. And I'll tell you how they do it. Today, all the cool kids are doing recursive neural nets. And this essentially is has these three, there's a bunch of cells. Each one has an input, processing, and output layer. And you've the input layer, the hidden layer, and the output layer. This produces some data. This is an encoder. You would put in something like, my hovercraft is full of eels. And then you get this data in. You start, gets back me. You put in me here, you get back aerodeslithador. You put in aerodeslithador here, you get back all the rest of it. So great, all you have to do is figure out what are the magical functions here. And there's also something called an attention mechanism that helps you figure out stuff that is sort of all smushed into here. So all you have to do is figure out what the input hidden and output functions are. Easy. The way you do that is you look at a tremendous amount of training data, and then you do relaxation, probability maximization, to find these functions. And now it just works. So that's clear? So if we can do this for English to Spanish, why can't we do this for English to code? It stands to reason it should be just as possible. And so we've done that. We've built a tool called Talina that is able to take as input something like find text files in the current folder and produces output find dot minus name star dot txt. How does it work? We fed it training data. We got about 8,000 pairs of text in a command. Those was collected manually from web pages like tutorials and Stack Overflow and that kind of thing. And we did a little bit of cleaning. Currently, it only handles uses of find and their English descriptions. It handles compound commands. It handles nesting. All strings are opaque, and so it doesn't handle command interpreters like if you have a use of awk or sed or something like that. And there are no bash compound statements, like for statements. The actual recursive neural net is totally standard. It's exactly the one that you would use elsewhere. The only thing that we've done is we've trained it on this instead of on the other. And it's a sequence-to-sequence encoder. You can imagine parsing this into a tree and parsing this into a tree and doing even better. We have some initial experiments on that, but it didn't actually help as much as we expected it to. So the accuracy is more than 70% here, which is kind of surprising. We're currently in the middle of a user study. So here we are thinking about adding more novel NLP techniques like a tree-to-tree decoder. Here's a big question. Is this good in practice? Suppose you have a tool that gives you great answers 2/3 of the time and lies to you the other 1/3 of the time. Is that actually helpful to people? So we're doing a user study right now where people are using our tool to see whether it helps them to be faster. So if you look at these lies, a lot of them are just totally syntactically non-valid. Some of them, but actually some of them, at least for me, were helpful because they told me, you know, I know how to use find, but I can't remember all the command line options. And there's one for every all 26 letters, but that's not even the long ones. So sometimes it gave me a hint of what I should actually be trying to do. So as long as you don't just execute the ones that contain RM in them, you're probably good.
Why you don't just reject the ones that aren't syntactically correct?
Because they sometimes give you a hint about, so, okay, the goal is not to completely eliminate the person. The goal is to show the person something that the person can either approve or will inspire the person. And so sometimes it tells you a good command line argument. So we could mark those. We could imagine taking them out.
Tell them, you know, this doesn't work, but it's, you know, try something like it. I mean, you know, you can, I mean, you know more about it than that in some sense. So, you know.
Yes, Patrice.
Can you please go back to the previous slide? So
sure.
You said 8,000 pairs? It's nothing.
Yeah, it's not very much.
And so also do you do, it's not like a word by word kind of training for natural language translation. You need sentences, right?
Correct.
So what's the equivalent for text command? So you would have a whole sentence in English, and then it, like in the previous example, like you have this, you throw an exception if blah, blah, blah in English, and then you would have a whole, what is a command?
Okay, so a command is a is bash syntax that starts with word find. So what we did is we had people search the web for occurrences of, for bash commands that start with word find, highlight that, hunt around in the web page for a sentence that describes it, highlight that, and then go on. That's the training data. Yes?
So I don't know how you ended up with this methodology, but it strikes me that find is perhaps the most complicated command in terms of how many arguments it supports and how complicated, and there are dependencies between the arguments.
Right.
Like in other words, this argument, you have to have these two other arguments for it to make sense, and if you have another argument, then it has a different semantic meaning. So find is just a mess in terms of arguments. So it just strikes
so,
me that. Yeah.
Right, we wanted to find something that isn't going to be easily handled by other techniques and is challenging enough. And maybe we made a bad choice. So if we look at related work, there's been a bunch of work in neural machine translation. We're just using this stuff directly. There's been some work in parsing from natural language to a formal representation. And then there's been a bunch of work that's most closely related to translating natural language to domain-specific languages. If you look at all of this, they're much simpler languages. We're trying to do something that's much more ambitious. And that's what I think makes it interesting. OK, so we're doing a bunch of other super cool software engineering projects, like analyzing programs before they're written and gamification of verification and so forth. So what this talk was about was thinking about how can we apply natural language to software engineering? We looked at four different problems. They used four different natural language sources, and they used four different increasingly sophisticated natural language techniques. I think the main takeaway is that software is a lot more than source code. We think of it as source code, and that's formal, that's powerful. And we should do a lot of that, and I love to do that. But it's not enough. We need to think about everything that's generated in the software development lifecycle, and we need to analyze them all. And so this is just really a very simple look at a few pieces of low-hanging fruit. And I think I'm hopeful that I and especially other people will continue to do more interesting and more exciting stuff in the future. So thanks very much for your questions. I really appreciate it.
All right.
I'm happy to answer more if there is, or you can take off.
I mean, it seemed like one of the takeaways for me is, as you go down the, you know, your list, the ability to reason about whether or not the answer is correct, you know, decreases in some sense, right? To the point where it's like, you know, this might be something close to what you want, right? So, you know, and that's not necessarily bad, but it does make it hard to evaluate. So how do you evaluate? Other, you know, you can do the user study. But again, I think at some level, it's, you know, unless you have it in the wild and you see people using it, you know, at scale, it may not be easy to understand the benefit.
On the other hand, it would be foolish to deploy this at scale and observe it in the wild unless we had some evidence that it's actually going to be useful. So, I mean, typically,
to task completion,
exactly.
Do a control study.
So, I like to do a control study as a last resort, right? Control studies are incredibly powerful. They tell you a lot about a very narrow domain, and you mostly need them if there's controversy in the field. If some people believe that something is true and other people believe that that is not true. So I usually do them when everyone believes something and I think they're wrong. Or I need to demonstrate something. Usually, I'd rather do case studies. put it in people's hands, observe them, get their feedback. You want to do that first anyway. You need to do that many times before you start to do a controlled experiment. So I think the thing to do is put it in people's, you know, try it locally, put it in people's hands, see if it works out, and then convince some early adopters to try it. If you need to do a controlled experiment, for the reason I'm doing a controlled experiment for this last one is that I want to know whether we need to figure out how to improve the natural language processing, or whether it's already good enough and we need to focus on the UI and the web interface and the integration with existing tools. So, I mean, I agree that this is all, it's all super squishy, right? I mean, where's the denotational semantics of this? I mean, what does it even mean without a denotational semantics, honestly? But I think it's really important to try it, and there are lots of ways in HCI that you can evaluate it. Yeah?
Now that you spend time thinking about and developing these techniques, are there any takeaways in terms of how to design programming languages or software engineering techniques that are more amenable to natural language processing?
That's a great question. So mostly I've been thinking about how do we deal with the programming languages that exist today,
right.
And where can we find the language that people are already putting into those. There is some work that claims that the structure of programming languages is similar to the structure of natural language, and the same analyses that you apply to natural languages should be applied to programming languages, for instance, to help you do better code completion. I actually believe that they have fundamentally different structures. I mean, one of them is biased by inherent structures in our brains and in society, and the other one is formal. But I think it would be interesting to think about that. I mean, one obvious thing is we should have richer type systems so you don't have to try to infer types from variable names. And so there are other things. You know, we should have code contracts instead of, you know, having to parse this out of Javadoc or other types of documentation. I'd be happy to talk about that later, though.
So
yes?
This is probably an ignorant question, but I don't know much about sequence translation, but is there a way to get a confidence interval out of that translation so that you sort of understand how much scrutiny you should give a translation?
Okay, yes to the first part, no to the second part. Yes, there is a confidence, and in fact, our tool, I'm happy to demo it for you, actually. We have it available online, actually gives you an arbitrary number. You can you can see the first 10 or so, and you can just keep scrolling and seeing more. So they're sorted. And I think the sorting is useful, but the absolute number doesn't really tell me much. It's the sorting that tells me which ones I should be looking at first.
That's not a score, a probability score that you can sort of give a particular translation.
No.
Okay.
But I mean, it's sort of the likelihood of this result being the correct translation. Yes, Andy.
So in the four examples you gave, it seems like your audience were expert programmers who both know the English and the formal language that they should be working with.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly,
true.
Find command is not something. It took me a while to learn about it,
right,
after learning Unix. Have you thought about what these applications might look like if you apply them to novice computer scientists, like, say, undergraduates who don't know how to ask the right question in the first place, to have it translated into the find command?
Yeah, so I think there's two really interesting ways you could take that. One is, how do you deal with people who don't know it at all, right? You have an existing programming language. The other is, how can we, and this is related to your suggestion, is how can we create a different type of programming language, something that's more like a natural language, so that people can write stuff in formal English instead of ever writing it in the code at all? And so that one I really haven't thought about. In terms of novices, I think it's actually really helpful to see something that says, I think this is probably the assertion you were looking for, and then you can tweak that or try to use it. And so if people say find or search, they don't need to know the find command, because if they say, what are the files that are, or search for the files, or print the files that, all of those get translated very similarly by our natural language translator and end up with something with find as the head command. Yes?
Do you imagine to make a public web service so that people can just type in what they want to find and you generate the find command for them?
Well, we have that. That exists.
I've already.
And I'll demo it for you if you want.
Oh, the find command.
I was thinking, to his point, that this would be useful in Windows for novice users. How do I add another user account to my computer? It would get you somewhere in the control panel, somewhere near users accounts. Even if it didn't give you the perfect recipe, it would help to start.
Right. So I told you we're doing a user study, and we're doing a user study against a search engine. So the idea is that Stack Overflow answers most of those questions very, very well. And we scraped all this stuff from Stack Overflow. But if something doesn't appear literally on Stack Overflow, like you're looking for the files that are bigger than a gigabyte and older than a month, then it doesn't do very well, whereas our system is able to generate that and give you a find command that does exactly that. So for most of the things that most people want to use, the MSDN or Stack Overflow or something is going to give them what they want. It's when they're slightly outside of the really standard things that this becomes really powerful.
I will pay you for something that tells me how to use Git.
Would you settle for world peace?
Git is great because they have the same operations with different names on different commands. Yeah, it's just wonderful.
I think,
remove, delete, I don't know, flip a coin.
I think everybody in the world has the kid in the office who knows the Git command you want to execute.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, maybe Git, so I don't know, maybe find it, maybe Git would be more complicated than find.
Yeah.
It is stateful. It's
yeah.
More stateful than find.
Yeah.
The wrong command.
Okay, other questions? Well, thanks very much. This is tremendous fun.